And before I introduce Clancy, I will just say a couple of words. So a month ago, Clancy was in the hospital with pneumonia. And I talked to him sporadically because he's so busy and he's so peripatetic and he's all over the world. And he got back from Australia on Tuesday of this past week after speaking 7 or 8 times in a week in Australia, 3 weeks removed from being hospitalized for pneumonia. And so I thought, you know, he's 87 years old, and he wouldn't mind me telling you that. And I thought, well, he's 87 years old, and he's just doing all this stuff. So I said, hey, Clancy, do you want me to have a wheelchair meet you at the gate? And his spiritual response was, hell no! So without further ado, I give you Clancy I from the Pacific Group in Los Angeles.
Whenever you get tired.
My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I have an unfortunate, too bad reputation in some areas of being crusty and kind of old grouch or something. And I want you to know that I'm not at all. I'm kind of a soft, warm, fuzzy type of person. I was sitting there thinking tonight, if I had one day left to live, you know what I'd do? I'd jump on a plane and fly to Atlanta and ask John to introduce me. It would make that last day seem like forever. John has really been very gracious. He met me at the airport in comedy of errors. They had 3 planes come in at the same time, so they took all the luggage off the first two and chatted. And finally, after about an hour, they got hours down there. But John was very gracious, and I said to him, just drop me off at the hotel if you would like to change clothes and freshen up a bit. He said, well, your hotel is on the other side of town, and we can't do that. Let's go right to the church. And I've never heard of that before. But I slunk into my bag and found a tie, so I put it on. So you'd never know. But if you want to see my suit, which is lovely, where's that meeting tomorrow night?
Fifth Tradition Group.
You could use it. All right. I'm very glad to be here. Very glad to be safe and sane and sober. And I've been thinking a little bit recently. I must say, on the way over here, we had a good time. We chatted, and I talked a little more than I should have. We stopped at Cracker Barrel, and I talked all the way through dinner. The only time I stopped talking is when the waitress says, who's going to take this check? I pushed it over to John. But I'm very glad to be here. Met some old friends here. Diane, who's I have the privilege of sponsoring long distance. And I think that your quarterly August is going to be very good. I sponsor 2 of the 3 speakers, and I'll tell them to be on the best behavior. And I'll be here for the international, of course. Our group is a big group in Los Angeles, and we have reserved 150 rooms for it. So we'll be down and have a good time. And I don't know if any of you were at San Antonio. That was a great convention, too, except it rained all the time. But they're all great. I think about the convention, how unique Alcoholics Anonymous is, how different it is from almost anything else, especially because it's been it was in my lifetime, and has had several times when it almost went on, almost finished. It really is spooky. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Some of you are kind of new, maybe you don't know all about it. But alcoholism, the disease, has been known for, written down about for 4,000 or 5,000 years. Somebody's leaving already. I get more interesting later. You should have seen me before I became mature. Anyway. But, there's written messages of alcoholism for 5,000 years. 4,000 or 5,000 years, talking about people who drink and can't seem to drink too much. They can't, nothing dissuades them. And even in 1930, which is my lifetime, I'm pretty old, you know. I was just a little boy then. Well, let me tell you one good thing about being old is that I had the experience that I'm sure nobody will ever have again. I know they won't, and maybe none of you ever did. But I had sat and talked to Bill Wilson for an hour. In 1963, I was in sober a few years, and I was in New York at a project. I get out of my project, and I thought, I'll go and see Bill Wilson. So I went to the World Service. I said, I'd like to see Bill Wilson, please. And the girl said, well, he's booked up every hour for at least 3 weeks in advance. I can get you in 3 weeks. I said, no, never mind. I won't be here. But I ambled off over to the archives. I looked through old pictures and old historic things. And all of a sudden, here comes Bill Wilson. He says, are you the young man who wanted to see me? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, my 11 o'clock didn't show up. Come on in. So we sat down and talked for an hour. And do you know what he said? I don't remember. I was more concerned about what he thought about me than what he was saying. But if I remembered, I would have told you. The only thing I remembered is at the end of our talk, I said, you know, Bill, at our home group, my home group in Los Angeles, last week we were going through the book and we got the book about that part of working with others where you so well tell how to talk to alcoholics. But you never tell them about going to meetings. Don't you people ever go to meetings for God's sake? He said, my boy, when I wrote that, there were no meetings. We had to take them to the Oxford group where we lost a great many of them. And why would he do that? Why would they lose them there? For a very simple reason. Because the alcoholics do not respond to religious appeals very often. In 1930, there was a very wealthy family in New York. And they had a big company. They were grooming their son to be taken over. But he had one kind of fault. He'd get terribly nervous sometimes. And he'd get drunk for a week. And they couldn't imagine what the hell was causing this. So they found the best psychiatrist in the world and wrote to him, explaining the situation, would you help our son? And the psychiatrist, Dr. Freud, said, no, I can't do that. I don't believe I can help him. Which is one of the first breaks we ever got. Other way, we might be all drunk tonight saying, but I dreamt I was sober. So they went to his colleague, Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung said, bring him over to my hospital. I was at Dr. Jung's hospital just a year ago in Zurich, Switzerland. And I looked around for the doctor who had been dead for 30 years. So missed that golden opportunity. But anyway, brought him over from New York. His wealthy family sent a couple guys with him to see that he got there. And he put him in the hospital. And he worked with him apparently off and on for a year, trying to break through the psychic bonds that were making him act so badly. And finally, after about a year, he said, Roland, he said, I think we've got it now. You've got it now. You've got a new look in your face. I'm going to send you back. I think you're okay now. And Roland was happy. And he went home. He stopped in Paris. Some friends of his family, wealthy friends, had a big dinner to celebrate his recovery. And they all toasted him with a glass of wine. He had a little glass of wine, and 3 days later he was face down drunk in his hotel room. And what happened? He didn't get nervous this time. So they took him back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung refused to take him back to the hospital. They said, why, doctor? He didn't mean any harm. He said, that's not the point, the doctor said. I'm afraid I misdiagnosed his case. I thought he had deep psychiatric and psychological problems that I could help him with. I see now that he is what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no treatment for that condition in the world today at any price. That was 1931, not very long ago. And Roland says, well, what does that mean, doctor? He said, what it means, Roland, is that you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. And Roosevelt thought, this is bad news. He said, is there any form of recovery at all other than just have to be like that? He said, well, the doctor said, at one time or another, I've looked through the literature, at one time there have been a few cases of what they, some inner change of psyche. They call it a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, but I've never seen one. I've never known of one personally. I've never known anyone who knew of one. He said, I believe your chances of being hit by lightning are better than having a spiritual experience. And Roland left with this outstanding feeling in his heart and went home. He didn't stop for any dinners in Paris this time. He came back in the ship, and on that ship he did something that apparently we all have to do somewhere along the line, although we don't always know we're doing it. He surrendered. He surrendered to the fact that he was helpless, hopeless. And he came back and he tried, he thought, what can I do to work towards this spiritual experience? And he was an elder in the Presbyterian Church. He already was a vestryman, as they call him. He was a very good spiritual, religious man. And one of his friends says, they have this new thing here called the Oxford Group. You want to look into that? And we hear that term all the time, Oxford Group. We don't often know what it is. In 1908, a minister in Pennsylvania, he felt that modern Christianity was getting too weak. He said, in the first century, people were willing to be crucified, upside down, burned at the stake for their belief. Now you can't even get them to go to church if it's raining. There's something wrong here. So he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association. And he talked about how we have... Where have you been? Well, you better run back there. Now I have to start over. I've lost my place. But, you know, he talked this religion up and intense. And he didn't get many people, not very many takers, you know. I don't think so, Reverend. I don't want to be crucified upside down, but thanks a lot. And so he didn't get much going. But he had a few little nuts together. And after the First World War, he went to Europe. And he thought, what a needless exposure. And he traveled through Germany and France and England, talking it up. First Century Christian Association, intensity! And not very many people. Of all things, he got to England, and the students in Oxford University thought, oh, isn't that wonderful? Just what we need, some more intensity. Incidentally, let me say one more thing to you, how AA works. Tonight, our chairman asked everybody on the committee to stand up, and they're all in the front row. And decent people are sitting in the back, but the committee's up here. Anyway, I'm not judging them. We don't judge people today. But anyway, these students took it up and they really got involved, so much so that the movement got known as the Oxford Group. And it took a different form. And he brought it back to the United States in the late 1920s. And it turned into kind of a thing where in each community of every major city in America that started Oxford Group would consist of upper class, good people meeting in one another's homes. And they would discuss how they could enhance their religious feelings, their feelings towards a spiritual being. And so you had some kind of clubs with them. And so when he said, have you heard the Oxford Group? Roland never had, but he went to see about it. And of all things, he thought it was good too. And he thought it had something to do with the Oxford University. It must be good. So he joined it and stayed sober. And he got very active in it and worked very hard in it and stayed sober for 2-3 years. And at the end of 3 years, his family got a hold of him and said, "Roland, we've now made you president of the company and you're doing a superb job. But you haven't taken a vacation. You need a vacation. Sometime this summer, why don't you go up to our home up in Vermont, where we used to, our summer home, where we used to take you and your little boy and you and your little friends up there. Why don't you go up there and spend a couple of weeks and just relax?" And Roland said, "Good idea. Thank you." So he went up there for 2 weeks. And the only thing that's miraculous about that, if he'd have gone 2 weeks later, we wouldn't be here. If he'd have gone 2 weeks earlier, we wouldn't be here. Isn't that funny? Just a funny thing. He happened to get there at the right time. And one of his friends came over and said, "Hi, Roland. Say, a boy that we used to run around with, heavy, he's turned into a terrible drunk. I know he used to drink pretty bad. Would you talk to Ebby and see if you could help him?" He said, "Sure, bring him around." So they brought Ebby over to Roland. Roland said, "Ebby, you got to start with this premise. You got to find a power greater than yourself." And Ebby said, "I don't want to hear that religious crap," and went and got drunk. So much for that. Well, the next day, Ebby was up to go to court, and the kid came back and said to Roland, Ebby's really screwed up this time. He got drunk last night and drove his car into somebody's house. And he's in court this morning for violating his probation. They're going to send him to the penitentiary. Would you come over and talk to the judge? He's my father, but he won't listen to me. Maybe he'll listen to you. He knows you're dead. Well, so again, Roland went over there, since he happened to be there, and said, "Well, Judge, as you know, I used to drink, and I found an answer to it in the Oxford group. If you would release him to my custody, I'll take him to New York and introduce him to the Oxford group, and perhaps that'll work out fine." The judge said, "Only because it's you, Roland. I wouldn't do this for anyone else, but I know your mother and father well. I know what you've been through, so I will permit you to do this. Take him out of Vermont. Take him to New York. But if you ever come back here, we'll put him in the penitentiary." So we took Ebby to New York and sort of stashed him in a mission on Lower Broadway and got him going to the Oxford group. And Ebby was not very happy with the Oxford group, but it was better than penitentiary. And he got involved finally. He got busy doing things, and he'd been doing it about 3 months. And Roland came by and said, "Ebby, you're doing a wonderful job. Time for you to testify." He said, "Testify? What the hell is that?" "When we get our feet on the ground here, we go out and find a friend that doesn't know about the Oxford group, and we testify with what we found. And that brings a message of hope." And Ebby said, "That's not like crap to me. I'd be embarrassed to testify." Roland said, "You want to go back to Vermont?" "No, I believe I'll testify. But who could I testify to that won't be embarrassed?" And he remembered one other chum he'd had when he was young, who lived in the same area in Vermont, come to New York, been a big shot on Wall Street, now was a drunken bum, living off his wife, lost everything, a failure in every regard. He thought of Bill Wilson. "I could go testify to that drunken fool if you only remember it the next morning." So we got a hold of Bill and made arrangements to come over. And our book talks about Bill went to the door, and here's Ebby, clean, sharp, alert. And Bill says, "God," he says, what have you been doing, Ebby?" He says, "I found religion." And Bill said, "Oh, shit." And he brought him in and sat down at the kitchen table. And Ebby talked about the Oxford. Well, Bill drank as fast as he could. "That's really wonderful, Ebby. I hope you give it up." And that hurt Ebby's feelings. He finally left. And he came back in 3 days. He had the Oxford group closer with him. "I want to talk to you about the Oxford group, Mr. Wilson. I think you'll define it very clever. Is Bill on a series of premises?" And Bill, "Oh, that's good." Got drunker than ever. And so he and Ebby left him. Closer and Ebby left with no sense of connection at all. And that was the end of that. 3 or 4 months later, Bill was musing one day amongst his various guilt. and thought, you know, I really treated Eddie badly. That poor dumb bastard was trying to help me. But he picked a bad way to do it. I really should tell him I'm sorry that I treated so badly that I drank so much. I hope I didn't get him to drink again. I'll go over and see where the missionary is. And I've got his card. And I'll tell him I'm sorry. So on an early November day, he went over to Manhattan from Brooklyn and got drunk on the way to build up his strength. Went to the mission. Ebby wasn't there. But he gave a short sermon anyway, just to show that he had wonderful work he was doing. Staggered on down the street. Next time he was back in the hospital, town hospital, that he'd been in several times already, because his wife's brother had connections so they could get him in there for nothing, because he had no money to pay for it. And this time it was a little different, because the doctor called his wife Lois and said, "Mrs. Wilson, I'm very sorry to tell you this, but your husband's back in the hospital. And this is probably the last time he'll ever be here. Because if you get another one of these dingbats, he'll be dead. One more, like, outing like this." He said, "We'll try to get him back to shape, but you must tell him not to drink anymore." And Mrs. Wilson said, "Oh, I try." And she called up Ebby at the, she had his card, and called him at the mission. And Ebby, "Would you go up to talk to Bill? He's going to die." So he took a couple guys up to talk to Bill and said, "Bill," he talked a little bit about what he had found. And he said, "You know, Bill, you must do something that we've all had to do. You must accept the existence of a power greater than yourself." Oddly enough, same thing that Roland had told Ebby. And Bill said, "Oh, I don't hear that religious crap." So they went home. In the middle of the night, this drunken ne'er-do-well had been doing nothing except drinking and making his wife's life hell. Woke up in the middle of the night, and his heart was pounding. He knew he was going to die. "If there's a God out there, show yourself!" And then suddenly his heart stopped pounding. The lights went on in the room as though somebody threw out a switch. A wind was blowing through the window that were closed. He said, "My God, I'm going crazy. I'm having a breakdown. But I feel so good. I don't know why. But then I can't understand this." And pretty soon he lay there. And pretty soon the lights went down off again. And the wind stopped blowing. And he went to sleep. In the morning, he told the doctor about it. He said, "Doctor, I'm afraid I had a psychiatric breakdown last night." And he explained this whole thing to him. The doctor said, "Bill, I don't think you've had a psychiatric breakdown. I'm looking at you. Something has changed in you. I don't know what it is, but hang on to it. Hang on to it." Turned out that Bill, for some reason, unknown cosmic contest, and had a spiritual experience. He didn't even know what it was, nor did his doctor. But he knew that he'd been visited by Ebby, and he undoubtedly now had a message to carry the drunkards everywhere to get him sober. And he went to the Oxford group, got involved in it. And then he, for about 6 months, he'd get up to his home in Brooklyn every morning, go to the Oxford group meeting, pick up some street drunk along the way, and bring him into these nice people. And that kind of dreadful, old, drunken, smelly slob. These people. I believe you're vomiting on my shoes, sir. And you take him home when they had no place to go. One guy even committed suicide at his house. And he tried to show him what to do. And no luck whatsoever. And he got up one morning after 6 months. He started putting on his clothes. Saw his wife putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve. She'd been a chic society beauty when he married her. Now she's an old, rather stout, gray hair coming. And she worked in the basement of a cheap department store so she could pay the rent. So he had gone his quest to help drunks. He said, "Lois, coffee pot's gone this morning. That guy I brought home last night apparently stole it to sell for wine. He said, I've been working with these people for 6 months every day and not one person stayed sober, and I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm going to get a job tomorrow but just shoveling dirt and get you out of that department store and get a life for you. And right then your life and mine hung by a thread about that big. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her about 40 years ago up in Connecticut. I said, Lois, how did you ever think that answer would change the course of history? She said, no. She said, obvious to me. When he said, not one person has stayed sober because of my efforts. And she said, you did. Oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair, in fact. You just go through that. Oh, yeah. But I'm doing something wrong. And he made arrangements to go down to a town hospital to see the old doctor that had straightened him out a number of times. And said, Doc, I think I've been given a gift to help people. But everybody I help gets drunk. What can I do? Doctor says, I don't know. I don't know. That's the problem. We don't know what to do. You guys get you drunk, we get you sober, give you some advice, you go home, pretty soon you're drunk again. We don't know what the answer is. Maybe there's no answer. And what do you tell these guys, Bill? Well, I try to instruct them how to have a spiritual experience. He said, well, that's ridiculous. There's no way to do that. He said, you know, I've always had a little feeling, and I've never had a chance to implement it because I'm not an alcoholic. But you know, alcoholics are strange people. They live in almost a shield, an invisible shield around them that nothing can get through. You can see them and you can hear them, but nothing ever gets through. Give them advice and thanks for the advice, really appreciate it. Thanks. Yeah, that's good. So they listen to nothing. They hide behind the shield of, but you don't understand, my case is different. The universal cry of all alcoholics, it turns out. He said, it's not been my idea that if someone would say, I know how you feel, because I'm a drunkard, ex-drunkard too, they would may listen to you. But I can't do it because they won't listen to me. I'm not an alcoholic. But maybe they listen to you, Bill. Why don't you try that? And Bill said, that sounds like a crappy idea to me, Doc. I don't see how that could possibly have worked for some drunk to know I'm a drunk. But he went home, and he found a letter from some big shots in Wall Street. They said, we understand you've been sober a while now, Bill, and you've cleaned up your act. You used to be a good guy. We hope you are again. We've got a deal going on in Akron, Ohio, where we're to fix up some proxies of a rubber manufacturing company, out there, rubber tool manufacturing company. We'd like to have you go out there for us, because you know proxies. Get enough proxies, and we'll take it over. You become president of the company, and you'll be on easy street for the rest of your life. However, if you screw it up, or if you get drunk out there, if you lose your way, don't even bother coming back, because you'll never work in this city again. And Bill said, oh, don't worry, I won't. And away he went to Akron. Got there a couple days later, the whole deal blew up in his face. It wasn't his fault, but nevertheless, it blew up. And it was hot Saturday morning in May. He stood in the hotel there and reached in his pocket. He had $10. He could either pay his hotel bill or take a railroad ticket home. He didn't know what to do. I stood in that very same spot in the early 1970s trying to recreate the feeling of what it must have been like. Of course, I couldn't. But over there, about close to where that exercise is, there was a door. And over the door, it had a curved sign in neon saying, cocktails. And he said he heard the sound of clinking glasses coming out of that door, and laughter, and music from the jukebox. And he started to water. And he had the feeling, and I'm sure it's the feeling I would have had probably, or anyone, almost anybody here, If I just had a couple drinks, I could think of an answer to this problem. Let's get it. At every step he took, your sobriety and mine would never come by. Out of the corner of his eye, he noticed across the room, across the lobby, on the wall, some big old payphones. A few young people. These were big old ugly black phones on the wall. You couldn't say, "I'll get me my home." Yeah. I don't know who left it here, but thank you very much, Tom. And he remembered he had promised his Oxford group friends that he would call somebody before he did anything drastic. So we went over to this payphone to get a nickel, which was what it cost. And in those days, maybe they still do it behind payphones. I don't know if they have payphones, but if they had payphones, behind them they'd have a big sign showing the leading churches in that community, their ministers, and their phone numbers. So in case you want a spiritual jolt, you go there and call them. And he called the first number on there. He said, "I'm Bill Wilson, I'm a rum hunter from New York, and I need to talk to somebody in the Oxford group, right?" And the man said, "I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me." Hung up. And so he called the second number. No answer. Called the third number. No answer. Called the fourth number. "Nice man," said, "I'm so sorry, sir, I can't help you. I don't have the relationship to the Oxford group, but I have a church, and I'm sorry, I wish I could help you. Wish you luck." And Bill Wilson said, "Well, I did what I said I would. I tried to call." Tried to walk towards the door. There's one last name on there that he hadn't called. A man named Walter Tunk. What kind of a morning would it be if I didn't get rejected by Walter Tunk? So we called Walter Tunk, who turned to be the only man in Akron who could have helped him. Our lives depended on him making that call. He said, "Funny you should call. I have a wealthy parishioner in West Akron who was telling me just the other day that in her Oxford group, they have a doctor who's a drunkard, and he admitted it just earlier this week. And they've been praying for him incessantly, but he hasn't sobered up yet. Let me get a hold of his wife. Maybe we can make arrangements for you to meet him." So he said, "Wait in that phone booth." So the doctor called the parishioner out of West Akron, said, "Yes, that'd be nice to have the Dr. Smith talk to somebody. I'll call his home." And she called his home, and the phone rang and rang and rang and rang. As she hung up, she heard a voice say, "Hello, I'm sorry I was out in the yard." And Mrs. Smith heard about this visitor from New York. She said, "Oh yes, I'd like to have the doctor talk to him, but he's drunk underneath the coffee table today. I don't think we can talk to him today, but we can do it tomorrow." So they set up a deal for tomorrow to come to this woman's big home out in West Akron. And she got the number from the minister and called Bill back in the hotel, who was about ready to leave the payphone. He had heard nothing. This is just nonsense. But she told him how to get a streetcar out there tomorrow morning to her house. And the next day was Mother's Day, 1935. And Bill Wilson went out to this mansion on a rattly old streetcar. And Dr. Bob and his wife and two children drove out there. The doctor was too hungover to drive, so he had a 16-year-old son, young Bob, they called him. Just an incidental aside, in 1980, at the International Convention, they introduced for the first time, "We have with us today Dr. Bob's son." And nobody ever heard of him. He had a son. We all jumped up and cheered. And it turned out, of all things, he was an Al-Anon. We were good sports. We cheered anyway. He stayed around as a result of that and started speaking at conventions all over at Dr. Bob's son. And he's a good guy, a good friend of mine. And one of the things he likes to talk about was driving out there to that house that morning. He said, my dad had me drive. So he was too sick to drive. And I sat in the front seat of my sister. And they sat in the back. And all the way up there, my dad said, "Ann, I'll go out and give this guy 10 minutes. But I'm so sick of being lectured, I won't be lectured anymore. I can't stand it. It doesn't help. It just makes me drink. I'm going to go out there and give him 10 minutes, no more." They got out there and they got together and had a little snack with their hostess. And these two guys went to a side room for their 10 minutes and were in there 4 hours and came out. And the doctor said to his wife, "My God, Ann, that's the first person I ever talked to who seemed to know how I feel. And when I have a drink, what it does for me. And when I don't drink, how bad it makes me feel." And I can't believe it. Apparently, Bill had tried the doctor's advice. And he said to Bill, "Bill, I got to talk to you more than this. Could you stay over maybe a week or two and we can talk some more?" And Bill thought, I have nowhere to get out of town. "Yes, I can stay." So he moved in with the doctor, and every day they spent 2 or 3 hours talking about the values of the action group and how to improve your relationship to a God and how to find yourself in a cruel world and how to do better. And the doctor just blossomed. And in the middle of the second week, he said to the doctor, to Bill, he said, "Bill, I know this is kind of a surprise, but I've just decided last night, I'd like to have you, if you could, stay here with my wife and 2 children over this weekend. I'm going to go to Atlantic City, where there's the National Convention of the American Medical Association. And I was there last year, and I was so drunk they ridiculed me and made fun of me and laughed at me. I'm going to go this year and show them I found something new." And Bill said, "Great." And he says, "I'll be back Tuesday morning." Way went. Tuesday morning early, the phone rang. Mrs. Smith answered. Woman on the phone saying, "Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry. This is the doctor's office nurse. They carried him off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And the station agent knew that I worked for him. And I went down and got him with a cab driver. We have him on the floor of the office here, and he's crying. He's so sorry. But I'm just afraid the experiment didn't work, so I'm so sorry." And Mrs. Smith said, "Okay, well, Mr. Wilson and I will be down to pick him up." They went down to pick him up the car and brought him home, which had to be a terrible trip. There are very few things that are more disgusting than a crying drunk. Jesus, they were just, "I'm so sorry." Now you're soaring yourself of a bitch. But they got him home and put him to bed. The big experiment didn't work. And suddenly, Dr. Bob sat up on Thursday morning. Said, "What day is it?" "It's Thursday morning, Bob." Said, "Oh my God. Oh my God. I've got to do a cancer surgery at noon, and I can't. They'll take my license. Look at my hand. I can't hold a knife. What can I do? Oh my God." They got him up and bathed him and clothed him. His new friend Bill got him some beer to steady his hand. So he went off to the hospital. "I'll be home by 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock he didn't come. 3 o'clock he didn't come. 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Everyone knew the son of a bitch must be drunk again somewhere. 6 o'clock he burst through the door cold sober. Says, "I'm home." I said, "Where have you been, Bob?" He said, "When I was doing that surgery, I got thinking somehow that in the Oxford group, they want you to make amends to people you hurt. And I've hurt a few people, but I never thought it should apply to a doctor. But I realized I'm a human being more than a doctor. So all afternoon I've been out making amends all over Akron. And I feel great." And that was June 10th, 1935, which they called the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous, because neither one of those guys ever drank again. Of course, they didn't know they were establishing a birthday of anything. Just two mopes trying to, "Well, try it again." But they realized one thing that changed the course of history. they realized that sitting around talking about your religious progress is not what had kept Bill Wilson sober. What had kept him sober was trying to help all those guys. He said, maybe we have to tell others about it in order to stay sober. I don't know. And the doctor said, I'll call up. I have a friend. At that time, you could not get to the hospital unless you had plumbing problems, gastroenteritis, or something physical, really. No drunks could get into a hospital, no matter how drunk they were. But there were people in the hospital who had plumbing problems who were drunk. And so the doctor said, I'll call up my nurse, Sister Ignatia, and ask her about it. And she said, do you have anybody up there that's secretly a drunk? She said, yes, I do. Yes, I do. He would really, we could help him. I'll talk to his wife and see if he can talk to you. You know, in 1960, at the International Convention where I was at, I heard Sister Ignatia tell that story. It was thrilling. I went to Pat Ford, I was young and vibrant, and thought I was, shook her hand, said, oh, Sister Ignatia, that's wonderful. Now, you never give her a kiss on the cheek? I thought, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. I remember, I think I said, I'm so sorry, is it wrong to kiss a nun? And I believe she said, as long as you don't get in the habit. I can't remember every little thing 60 years ago, for Christ's sake. Anyway. So anyway, Sister Ignatia started the process, and I heard the guy in the hospital that time, Bill D, yeah, I heard him talk about 40 years ago. He said, I was laying on that bed in Akron, Ohio, and my wife came in and said, two fellows want to talk to you about drinking. I said, absolutely not. I'm done talking to people about drinking. I'm sick of getting sick of damn lectures. No one's going to talk to me anymore about it. No, don't ask. I said, but my wife's a rather strong person. And I talked to those two fellas. And they were talking about drinking once. They go, they're drinking and how it made them feel when they drank and how it made them feel when they went on the wagon. And I couldn't believe my ears. I thought, my God, I thought I was the only one in the world. And there's two more. See, I was so impressed by those two guys. I stuck with them and I became number three. He was the third in the chain of all of us. And then they wandered around Akron a while trying to get people to find drunks who didn't have to go to the hospital unless they had something wrong with them. They didn't do very well. A little sidebar, cheers me up. They ran across a guy named Ernie, who was 29, and he was kind of a bad drunk. And they said, you can't be an alcoholic at 29, Ernie, but you do drink like one. You can come with us. He'd go around with us. But then it got immersed. He fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter and brought our organization, new as it was, its first relationship. I don't know a word that sends us shoving down a sponsor's spine like that one. I want to talk about my new relationship. Oh, Jesus. You have to have a phone that says, he's leaving it. You hear wonderful things like, gee, I said, Fred, now you told me last week about Gloria and how you loved her. Yeah, I did, but when I saw Margaret walking out of detox this morning, I just said, but they went on and got married. Wasn't that wonderful? That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, fell in love with the guy I sponsored, who was about 5 years sober. And I was dead set against it. But I have a family full of daughters, all who know much more than I do. Oh, Dad, you just stay out and we'll take care of it. But I'll give you the absolute epitome of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything if you give little hints. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home. But they got married, very touchy. And they told Ernie, now you're a new bridegroom. We don't want you out walking the streets going to the Oxford group with us all the time. You stay home and take good care of your wife. You're a young husband now, and you've got to take care of your wife. I said, okay. So he stayed home and didn't join them anymore. And they felt very bad when he got drunk. And stayed drunk for 50 years. I remember young Bob, who got to be a friend of mine, told me some years ago, he said, I got some good news today. Ernie called me. He'd been sober a year. This was 50 years later. And turned her against AA for all those years, just about. But that's a, hey, Bill went back to New York and started a group there and with the help of some leading Oxford group members. And they had the Oxford group and they had these two little groups struggling along. And little by little, the people in the Oxford group were getting tired of these drunkards. The guy in Akron finally sent him a letter and said, we understand that you're doing wonderful work, but our members come for spiritual enhancement, not to listen to how often you got drunk. I wish you'd meet somewhere else. So they had to leave. Some years later, he wrote a letter and said, I'm so sorry. I had no idea what that was all about. And in New York, they got away from the Oxford group and began having meetings as alcoholics. They got a break in Akron because they had a, kind of a big group from Cleveland came down to join the meetings all every week. And the bishop of Cleveland said, you can't go down there anymore. You're Catholics. We don't want you going to Protestant church ceremonies. So they had to start their group up there. And one of the old guys said, what do we call ourselves? And that's where the term Alcoholics Anonymous came from. They stumbled on that phrase. And they grew up little by little. And by, they had quite a few people going and staying sober now. 100 or so. 1939, they thought, if we just get some publicity, people would learn about us. And they got a guy in the Liberty magazine, which was a little magazine at the time, and he wrote an article about it, but it made it sound like a religion turned whatever people off that was interested in. At the end of 1940, the biggest publication at the time was the Saturday Post. And they had a writer who specialized in uncovering corruption. He just uncovered the corruption in the Philadelphia labor movement, which was a big deal. And his editor said, I want you to worm your way into this new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and let's get all the dirt on it. So he said, okay. And he went to AA in New York and St. Louis and Chicago, wherever there was meetings. And he called his editor and said, Jesus, I don't know what to tell you, Jim, but they're doing what they say they're doing. No one's making any money. He said, huh, I'll write the story anyway. We'll do something with it. So we wrote the story and it appeared in March 1939, 1941, Saturday Post, about Alcoholics Anonymous. First time it, they talked to, it had pictures of the AA members with their faces blacked out. And it really is a sickening looking sight. And it took the country by storm because so many people in the country had relatives, father, son, brother, sister, had someone who was an alcoholic and they couldn't do what to, didn't know what to do with them. And at last there was an answer to that problem, apparently. And so they buried New York in letters. Oh, Jesus, tell us what to do. And Bill would send them a book. They'd written a book in 1938 to raise some money and it didn't. But they sent him a book. They had a lot of books left over. They didn't sell. And a little note on what AA was, and pretty soon there were AA groups all over the country. Little groups of people staying sober. And Bill would send them little notices now and then, keep it up, keep it up. 1943, we were in a war. And I remember in 1942, I ran away from home and went, ran away to sea. I had no idea all these things were going on, of course. I just hadn't thought about it now. What if I had done if I'd known about it? Nothing. But Bill started getting letters from some of these little groups saying, don't send us any more news because our group is extinct. We had fights in the group and people quit. And by the end of the year, they were getting several of them. In 1944, they got a whole bunch of them. And they realized, my God, he's going extinct. Maybe so he started the Grapevine. It's kind of a tabloid. He thought if people read each other's stories, they'll do better. It helped a little, not much. 1945, he was moving rapidly towards extinction. And Bill thought, we have to somehow get the word out that what we're doing here, that we're not trying to just tell people to stop drinking. We have a program of action. And Bill and Dr. Bob lives in Akron, and Bill lived in New York, and they always got along rather old, but their followers didn't like each other, as is the case often in AA. People in Akron said, well, we don't want to be like the big city swindlers in New York. And New York said, well, we're not going to be like those shit kickers out in Akron. Okay? But Bill and Dr. Bob told them to get together and create some place for a meeting where representatives from all over AA could come. And they couldn't get together. So Bill and Dr. Bob, oh, they all got along well. They got together and said, Cleveland. Okay. So in July of 1950, in Cleveland, the first big group of sober alcoholics in the history of the world sat down in Akron. I have the tapes of that weekend. It's fascinating. The quality of the tapes are poor, but it's very good. Most of the speakers were not alcoholics. They were, because they wanted people from outside to see they weren't crazy people. They were just doing good. So the warden of Sing Sing and the warden of in California, they had government people and so on. And the first meeting on Friday, they had a speaker, Dr. Bob, and he was dying of cancer. They said, you probably don't want to talk, Bob, because you're very sick. He said, I've got to. I'm 15 years sober. I've got the second longest sobriety in the whole world. And he always was a better 12-stepper than Bill. And so that day, his son on one side and guy on the other side took his tall, gaunt man to the podium in Cleveland. Said, I want to welcome you friends to Cleveland. I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we're all the same. We all get out of the way when we put into it. He said, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months and my health hasn't come back the way I hoped. He said, I just a bunch of talk. But then, he said, I wanted to call your attention to two or three things that may be important. And he knew he was trying, and he was trying to lump in a short time whatever he knew about AA to get these people going. He said, first, let us remember to keep this program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. There isn't a person in this room or in a room like it doesn't know exactly what he meant. We're all wonderful, but things are going our way. Love is the answer. But then somebody hurt our feelings. Might even put the ultimate curse on them. I don't even think he's alcoholic. Which is kind of funny because we spend half our adult life avoiding that title, and the worst thing that can happen is we may lose it. No, I'm an alcoholic. And finally he said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it, to take us to a few meetings. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are too busy to help our friend who still suffers in the blackness of alcoholic despair. And he sat down and died a few months later. But that kind of became the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. If when you go to the World Service Office in New York and you step off the elevator, that whole speech is on the wall there for you. It's a very touching thing. But later on in that convention, Bill Wilson spoke on Friday night, as he did from every Friday night at all the conventions after that. I'll tell you something while I'm still alive. Well, let me see. And tell you, 10 years later, the convention, or 15 years later, the, or 20 years later, the convention was in Miami Beach. And we all gathered there. And there were 15,000 people in this big auditorium. Because Bill Wilson was going to talk, just you could cut the excitement with the knife. Everybody, boys, great Bill Wilson! The guy came out, I'm very sorry to tell you that Bill is too ill to talk. We didn't know that he was dying of emphysema. Nobody knew that. He said, we have a substitute, Fred. I think that but Fred talks and we have just near the end of his talk, someone came out and whispered in his ear. He turned to us. I have a wonderful announcement. An ambulance has just brought Bill to the back door of this building. And we're going to wheel him in because he wants to say a few words. And Bill Wilson was wheeled in. And God, we all jumped up and cheered. The organist played Climb Every Mountain. And it was just wonderful. And Bill Pullman said, I'm happy to be here. And all I'm doing God's work. And he said a few words and slumped back in his wheelchair and they wheeled him out. He's dead shortly there after that. A great golden moment though in AA, I'll tell you. But little by little, AA grew. And it grew little by little all over. And pretty soon they had AA in all the states, Canada. And one guy in Minneapolis who really was a crackerjack. In 1941, the two big football teams in America were Michigan and Minnesota. And Michigan came to Minneapolis to play Minnesota. There was a little guy in Chicago who was sober about 3 months. And he got up to see his alma mater play. They told him, now, we've got these letters from Minneapolis. If you get a chance, call at them. Tell them about AA. Oh, yeah, I sure will. And away he went. And during that game, there was a big snowstorm. And I remember that snowstorm because I was playing football 90 miles away in a little town in Wisconsin. We started off in grass and got up to our knees in snow. But he was stuck there. He couldn't get out of there. Train was canceled. So we had to go to the end of the call on this guy. And he called it, went over to see him, and got stuck in his house. Couldn't get out of the house. Snow so bad. So he told him everything he knew, and then some. Things he made up. For 2 days. And this guy just, yeah, I got it. And he went on to start AA in Minnesota, and Western Wisconsin, and Canada, and the South Dakotas. A couple of years ago, I was asked to speak at the 50th anniversary of that his visit there. And it was a meeting like this. But the chairman said, we have a special treat today. Chan is with us. Who's Chan? That's the nickname of the guy that came up from Chicago. And this little old man came up and, well, I never thought it would turn out like this. It brought tears to it. But anyway, all over A grew, as you all know. Eventually got into Ireland in 1947, England in 1948, and a little by little spread around. And now it's in a lot of countries, 152 or something. Millions of sober alcoholics. And we just take that for granted, but we forget It was all due to a series of little funny things that had to happen just right. If he hadn't called back to call Dr. Tunk, we wouldn't be here. If he had decided to go have that drink in the room with the girls, we wouldn't be here. There's so many things. If Mrs. Smith hadn't run in from the yard and answered that phone, she said it was being hung up. And on and on and on, just all sorts of things. And yet, it grew. And it grew remarkably well. And today it's all over the world. I've been active for a lot of years, so I've had a chance to see it. I was just speaking in Bangkok and Rio de Janeiro and all over Europe. And last December in Spain, where I got so sick I got pneumonia on the way home. Rotten Spaniards. I'm not judging them. I'm just reporting. But I've been a lot of places. You'd think you'd find a variety of AA in all these countries, but except for the accents, you hear the same crap you hear in your home group, you know. Well, I thought she loved me, but I just found out she didn't. Yeah, I know that story, yeah. They hate me in work, they're jealous of me. Yeah, I know that story. That's why AA works all over. Because it works at a level below our differences. Our differences are manifest on the surface. We look different, talk different, drink differently. Yet when you get down to a certain level, we're all the same. I must have over the years heard over 100 fifth steps, I guess. And they're all the same. They have different specifics, different facts, different. But they all contain guilt and defiance and fear and loneliness and amazement they are stuck where they are. So the great thing about AA, it gets through that wall, gets down to where it does the business. And that's why people who stop drinking and can't stop don't realize that the problem is not alcohol. If it were alcohol, we'd all quit and be home free. It's alcoholism. And that's the difference from alcohol in that alcohol is overcome by stopping drinking. In alcoholism, it enhances it. It makes it worse. Who would ever guess such a thing? So we gather together all over the world and we talk about these things and try to find ways to say, try to do this, try to take that inventory, try to talk to someone about it, try to have a sponsor, try to get involved in things. Like tonight, we were talking about this quarterly meeting in August. I hope you all go to that, because it'll be good stuff. So the speakers are good, but more important than that, you sit with other people who feel the way you do, and you get to make new friends. One of the great things about the international, staggering around those cities, I've been every one of them. You know, the badge with their name on it. Hi, Jim! Oh. And it's just a remarkable experience. From all over the world, people, and they talk the same, they sound the same, they face the same problems. And you can sit down with any one of them and have a cup of coffee. It's as though you've known them for 6 months. Yeah, I understand. You know, it really is a great experience. So I hope you'll sign up for both the international and for the quarterly, because they're both great events. But because Alcoholics Anonymous, in the last analysis, is exactly the same tonight on the outskirts of Atlanta. What's the name of this place? Outskirts of Atlanta, that's the name of the place. It's exactly the same as it was in Akron in 1935. It's always the same. All the panoply and all the noise and all the blah, blah, blah. But what it boils down to is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different, at least enough, so that perhaps he'll take an action he does not yet believe in. And that is the ember of surrender. And you gotta kind of blow on it. You gotta surround yourself by people who are going the same direction you are. Stay away from the smart aleck fringers who say, Stay away from those people. Stay away from the people who are trying to do the right thing. And one day, the magic of AA is this. The thing that makes AA, the secret of AA is this. It's steps, sponsors, meetings, actions are designed to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To make my life worthwhile. And me full of self-contentment and knowing that I can do it. And so therefore it's all very nice that we have to get these things together. That we find things in each other and life. It brings about a difference in your perception of reality. I think it's kind of funny. When I came to AA, I would leave a room if they mentioned God because I felt so bad about what God had done to my son, killed him while I was in jail. And yet, I couldn't go to sleep tonight if I didn't say a prayer to God that I came to believe in long after I was sober. That's what you're here for. You don't have to believe. You don't have to be an old timer. Become an instant old timer. You start from where you are. It says, came to believe. You start from where you are. And it saved my life that I came to believe in my sponsor. And he got me to do things that nobody else can get me to do. So I'm here tonight. And I'm glad to report I'm safe and sane and sober. I don't have pneumonia. And try to be tolerant to my host. Glad to be here. God bless you.